Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, Egypt experienced one of its bloodiest days since the uprising of 2011, which toppled Hosni Mubarak. At dawn on Wednesday, Egyptian riot police, backed by armored vehicles, bulldozers, and helicopters, launched a bloody crackdown on the six-week-long sit-ins by supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi in Cairo. These deadly clashes have left more than 525 people dead, resulted in over 2,000 injuries. The White House joined a number of other countries in condemning the violence. This morning, President Obama condemned Egypt's interim government, saying the U.S. is canceling a planned joint military operation, but there was no indication that the U.S. is prepared to cut its $1.3 billion in annual aid to Egypt. Also yesterday, after weeks of shuttle diplomacy by the State Department, Israel and the Palestinian Authority kicked off their first round of peace talks at an undisclosed location in Jerusalem after Israel published plans for 3,100 new settler homes. Now, this isn't getting much attention because of the bloodshed in Egypt. And then if you look at other events in the Middle East, the UN is sending a chemical weapons team to Syria, where 100,000 people have died in that bloody conflict. There was a car bomb in Iraq today, killing at least 34 people. It's safe to say that the Middle East is in turmoil. So on today's Your Call, we're going to put this in perspective and really talk about U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. At this point, how much power does the U.S. have in the region? How is it responding to the violence happening in Syria, in Iraq, in Egypt? What are its interests at this point? Today, we are joined by Stephen Walt, professor of international affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He is co-author of the book, The Israel Lobby, and he joins us from Boston. Hi, Stephen. Welcome back to the show.
Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Sheila Carapico. She's professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond in Virginia. This past semester, she was at the American University in Cairo. Hi, Sheila. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you. So, Sheila, I'll start off with you since you recently spent some time in Cairo. I mean, when you look at what happened in 2011, there were many dark days, but what we saw yesterday is completely unprecedented. Can you just talk about how serious this is?
Oh, I mean, this is very serious, and even the death toll that you just cited, I think, it's now increased because, of course, a number of injured people end up dying overnight, and by some accounts, it matches the death toll from yesterday. Matches the 18 days between January 25th and February 11th in 2011, which was so-called the revolution. And you do have to wonder why the military decided to use so much force. I mean, I sort of understand why they decided to disperse the protest, but it could surely have been done in a less bloody way. And so this is very, very dire indeed. I think people in Cairo are, they're angry, they're upset, they're frightened, they're confused. It's a very dark day.
Stephen, what would you add to that? How critical is this?
I think it's a pretty remarkable moment. I mean, in one sense, it isn't. In the following narrow sense, that what's happening in Egypt is going to take a long time to work out. Mm. It's not going to be resolved in a week or a month, or in my view, even a year. But on the other hand, the fact that the military government decided to use this much force, as Sheila said, is worrisome because, in a sense, they appear to be making the same mistake that the Muslim Brotherhood made when they were controlling the government, essentially trying to play a sort of winner-take-all game where they suppress all the opposition, run things themselves, rather than starting to develop a political system there that begins to share power among the different factions within Egypt.
What explains this bloody crackdown? Why would the military go to these steps and kill so many people?
Well, I think you can't rule out stupidity. I think this is a blunder that raises the prospect of greater violence down the road. The Muslim Brotherhood has been in existence in Egypt for decades. It is well organized. It commands a fair degree of support. It's not going to be driven out of existence by a crackdown like this. Instead, it tempts them, of course, to use violence in response, and you have the danger of a situation that could escalate, as we've seen in Syria and elsewhere. Ultimately, what's going to have to happen is some kind of sharing of political power over time, where all groups feel represented and all groups feel that they have a voice, even if they, say, didn't win the last election. But I think we are a long way from that particular moment, and the military's belief that they can sort of restore order with a display of force, I think, is going to prove to be mistaken.
What did you make of President Obama's announcement this morning? John Kerry was receiving a bit of criticism for basically saying that both sides need to be restrained. President Obama came out strongly this morning condemning what's been happening there, saying that the U.S. is canceling a planned joint military operation. But he didn't go as far to say that the U.S. would stop giving Egypt $1.3 billion a year. Sheila, what were your thoughts on President Obama's statement?
Well, I mean, you know, we keep using the term giving the Egyptians $1.3 or $1.5 billion a year in aid, but it isn't, of course, anything like a gift. I mean, what we're doing is providing American weapons, and American weapons manufacturers have a huge stake in maintaining that relationship. So I think that although the president sounded as if he were speaking forcefully, the actual kind of suspension of joint military exercises is pretty much a purely symbolic gesture that doesn't get to the heart of the matter at all, and, you know, is certainly not equivalent to the level of criticism that we would be hearing from the president and others in Washington if a similar, a lot of Egyptians are saying, massacre occurred in a country with which we don't have such a strong military relationship. So I wasn't particularly impressed by the president's comments.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the aid, because it's a little unclear about how that money is spent, and we will talk about that. But first, Stephen, what was your response to President Obama's statement this morning?
Well, as you would expect, he said a lot of the right things. I mean, the tone of his remarks, you know, hit a lot of the right notes about how we deplored what had happened, and ultimately the Egyptians would have to work this out for themselves, that we weren't going to try to dictate solutions, things like that. But as Sheila noted, the actual response was quite minimal. Canceling the exercises is largely meaningless. It's something you could even argue the Egyptian military has too much on its hands already. The last thing they need to do is be spending some time exercising with American forces. More importantly, as long as the aid package continues to go through, we've done essentially nothing, and we will still be associated with the regime in the eyes of the Egyptian people and in the eyes of people elsewhere in the region and around the world. Moreover, military aid is not what Egypt needs right now. The generals do not need more tanks or planes to fly around in. What Egypt needs is a variety of other forms of assistance. So even if the United States wanted to provide aid to Egypt, I would think military assistance is sort of the last thing they need right now.
What is the relationship at this point? I mean, what is the United States foreign policy in Egypt? And how have you seen it change since Mubarak was ousted?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, first and foremost, the United States wants Egypt to be a source of stability in the region, and in particular, they want the United States, they want Egypt to maintain the peace treaty with Israel. I think that's been a primary concern ever since the Arab Spring came along. There was no danger, it seems to me, that that was likely to get disrupted, because Egypt has really no incentive to get back into a serious military confrontation with Israel, which is much more powerful than Egypt is right now. We would like to see the Egyptian economy do better. We would like to see more Egyptians be employed, particularly young Egyptians, and we would like to see a government that was more participatory and that respected human rights. All of those things, you know, are sort of what the United States would want. But what the United States has not been able to develop since the Arab Spring hit is a consistent policy that might nudge Egypt in that direction. And I think what that indicates is how limited American influence actually is in many parts of the Middle East now.
And Sheila, what would you add to that?
Well, I would add to that, and I appreciate the points Stephen just made, just that in a certain way, nothing changed in our policy towards Egypt from the previous three decades or so. In other words, we continue the aid package. We continue you know, certain other kinds of programs, including democracy promotion for what it's worth and so forth. But I think the key word that Stephen used is stability, and I think the stability of the U.S.-Egyptian relationship has been paramount. And then the other thing I would add, although it's not quite directly related to your question, but in until you know, this the coup or the Tamarod movement got so many people in the street in protest of Morsi, there was a huge conspiracy theory, really widespread in Cairo, including among the English-speaking intelligentsia, that the U.S. was actually backing the Muslim Brotherhood and had, in fact, helped to install the Muslim Brotherhood, which I think was preposterous on the face of it, but a testimony to the sense that a lot of Egyptians have that the U.S. does have more influence than I believe it has, and also that, you know, that the Americans support whatever Egyptian government there is. And that last part of it, I think, is probably true.
Well, so what do you think about the U.S. and its relationship, or I mean, in the future with the Muslim Brotherhood? Are they going to accept the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, if the Muslim Brotherhood were in power, the United States would try to do business with them and try to work with them. I think what we're seeing here, if you sort of step back from the immediate events, though, is what we're seeing here is the set of difficulties that people anticipated were going to take place in the Middle East at some point. Middle East experts have known for a long time that these societies were under tremendous pressure. Their economies were largely stagnant. They had a huge youth population that was not finding adequate opportunities. There were dissident movements of various kinds that were being kept in check by police states, essentially. And that sooner or later, this was going to blow. Now, nobody knew exactly when. It finally began to blow in 2009. And everyone has worried what that would mean, because once you sort of take the lid off a lot of these governments, putting back a stable political order turns out to be very difficult to do. And it is Obama's misfortune that he's the president who happens to be in office when something people had feared for many years finally comes to pass. The problem for the United States is that we are, in a sense, reaping the consequences of 30 or 40 years where we kicked a lot of these cans down the road, backing governments that weren't particularly effective or legitimate, turning a blind eye to some of Israel's various predations and being blamed for that, and at various points, as with the invasion of Iraq, going in and destabilizing things ourselves. And in a sense, we are now paying the price for many years of misconduct.
And so when you look at the Arab uprising in 2011, you see the emergence of new players like Qatar. Well, not new, but more influence of Qatar and Saudi Arabia. You see Saudi Arabia's footprint in Yemen and Syria. So, I mean, when you put all of this in perspective, what is the United States faced with right now in the Middle East with all of these different players and different players exerting more power?
My view is that we're faced with a situation where the local actors are going to play a more active role, and where it's going to be very difficult to forecast exactly who wins out. You know, we've seen that in Syria, where what initially began as a peaceful protest against the Assad government has been transformed into a civil war in which the upper hand among the opponents, at least, is held by a bunch of groups that we think are actually pretty dangerous, groups linked to al-Qaeda as well. I think what that suggests to the United States is to, again, take a deep breath and understand that the United States actually doesn't have very many genuinely vital interests in a lot of these places. We do care about what happens. We're concerned for moral reasons. But our strategic interests are not directly involved in most of these struggles. And the more we try to meddle in them, the more we try to socially engineer what are very complicated political processes, the more we're likely to be blamed, and the more we may actually make things worse without intending to.
And Sheila, what did you want to add?
I was going to add that, the piece of this, I think, which is relevant to U.S. security interests and then also to some of the other specific conflicts, most notably Yemen, but also Syria and Egypt, is the Saudi role. We hear more about the Qatari role, but the Saudi role, I think, is more important. And the United States considers that the stability and continuity of the Saudi monarchy, which of course is probably the least democratic and certainly the least open society in the region, we have a very strong relationship with Saudi Arabia. They, of course, buy their weapons as opposed to being given them. And they clearly fund, either as a government or as individuals within the royal family, are funding some of the movements that are most disruptive. So I think one of the things that Americans really need to understand more about, but it's hard to research, is the nature of Saudi meddling and the ways in which the United States supports Saudi Arabia regardless.
Can you tell us more about that? Just how has the Arab Spring affected Saudi Arabia and its influence in the Middle East and the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States?
Well, Saudi Arabia is very frightened, of course, by the prospects of revolution anywhere in the region. And again, perhaps most especially in Yemen because it's right next door, but also in Egypt and elsewhere. I mean, they're known to oppose the Muslim Brotherhood, but to have fostered the Salafist movement and, you know, longer ago, even the roots of Al-Qaeda. They don't want democratic outcomes. They may very well have encouraged this very violent crackdown on the part of the Egyptian military against the Brotherhood. They're clearly stepping up assistance to groups inside of Syria, to groups inside of Egypt and elsewhere. And so they have a view of the Middle East as being kind of an extension of their influence. And I think the United States gives excessive deference to Saudi wishes in all matters, including Iran, Syria, Egypt, Yemen.
And Stephen, have there been any changes between the United States and Saudi Arabia under the Obama administration?
Well, I think the general sense is that the Saudi government has not been very happy with the Obama administration for two main reasons. One, they feel the Obama administration was insufficiently supportive of the Mubarak government in Egypt and helped play a role in their view, throwing Mubarak over the side. And second, they would like the United States to take a more confrontational position towards Iran, which they worry about as a potential rival in the Gulf region. I think what's quite interesting about this is the United States really has two special relationships in the Middle East, one with Saudi Arabia and the other with Israel. And in a number of these instances, the Saudis and the Israelis are basically lined up tacitly together. Israel very worried about Iran, Saudi Arabia worried about Iran, and wanting the United States, of course, to do the heavy lifting to solve that problem. Similarly, the Israelis have been very concerned by the implications of the Arab Spring, in part because they worry about what happens in Egypt, much as the Saudis have worried about it as well. And, of course, in both these cases, the United States has been much too deferential to both of these particular allies, in a sense letting those countries drive our Middle East policy instead of having one that reflected American interests first and foremost.
That is Stephen Walt. He's professor of international affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, and he's co-author of The Israel Lobby. We're also joined by Sheila Carapico, professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond in Virginia. And today we are talking about U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. At a time of major turmoil, at least 525 people are dead. Massive violence yesterday, one of the bloodiest days since the uprising in Egypt in 2011. We are hearing about UN inspectors, chemical inspectors going to Syria, where 100,000 people have been killed. Reuters has a new piece right now called Yemen Leader Basks in U.S. Favor as Drone Strikes Fuel Rage. In Iraq, there was a car bombing today, yet another one. It seems like this is happening every few days. 34 people died. And then yesterday, the Israelis and Palestinians met for their first round of peace talks. So today we are putting all of this into perspective and talking about the U.S. role in the Middle East. How have things changed as a result of the Arab Spring? What questions do you have about what's happening on the ground in the Middle East? And What really strikes you when you hear President Obama and John Kerry talk about all of these issues? What interests, how have interests for the U.S. changed in the Middle East? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we'd love to hear your thoughts on the major power shifts that we're seeing there. And let's hear from Eid in Berkeley, who is from Egypt. Hi, Eid. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, good morning. You know, I grew up in Egypt and actually was aware of the Muslim Brotherhood since I was a tiny kid because they had a cell close to our neighborhood. And the hypocrisy in them is just unbelievable because even though I used to be a friend of many, you know, they talk about religion and God and everything, but then you notice that when your sister walking down the street, their eyes are not on the road. So they really hypocritical group. I put most of the blame on them, totally. I think that the army was put in a very bad position because the Muslim Brotherhood does not really care about what is good for Egypt. All they care about is what is good for the Muslim Brotherhood, proselytizing and spreading with the distorted version of Islam, mainly dealing with women, how women dress, what women do with their body. And when I left Egypt in the 60s, in Cairo had far better life than San Francisco did at the time when I came to San Francisco. The fact Egyptians enjoy and love their freedom. Their women love to dress any way they want, even though you see many dressed today in this awful cover-up and all of that stuff. So I put all of the blame on the Muslim Brotherhood. Egypt is a secular country. It is the mother birth of all of the three religions. You cannot have one religion take over. People can have freedom. Mm. That's the last thing I like to say. The old Egyptian flag before Nasser changed it in the 50s was a green background and three stars. One star for Christianity, one for Judaism, and one for Islam. And this is how most Egyptians are far more open-minded, like myself, than many Americans are when it comes to religion issue or other issues. So,
well,
totally, totally. And that's my point of view, by the way, represents my family in Cairo, represents a lot of people in Egypt.
Well, thank you, Eid. Thank you for calling, Eid, and I hope that your family and friends are okay, because I saw a photojournalist essay this morning, and it's just horrific, horrific violence. So thank you so much for calling in, Eid. We have a question from a listener in Berkeley on Egypt who says, I find it interesting that most U.S. establishment journalists, pundits, and politicians, the more conservative, the more likely, like John McCain and Pat Buchanan, were beforehand criticizing or condemning Morsi's ouster, first led by the majority of the Egyptian people and defending an Islamist who was in the process of setting up a virtual or literal Islamic caliphate. I suspect Morsi's close cooperation with U.S. and Israeli interests. Can your guests comment on this?
Well, again, I mean, this was Sheila. Very much reflective of a widespread view in Egypt during the Morsi administration that the United States was very much complicit with the Brotherhood. And I think, ironically, I mean, that perception has intensified both anti-Brotherhood sentiment, as we heard from the caller who was speaking online, and also against the United States. So you have kind of the ironic situation, I think, where most Americans don't think that our government likes the Brotherhood or supports the Brotherhood, and I don't think the Brotherhood feels that the United States supports them, but there is a lot of that opinion in Egypt.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'd love to hear from you. We're talking today about U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East with Sheila Carapico, professor of political science at the University of Richmond in Virginia. This past semester, she was at the American University in Cairo. Stephen Walt is professor of international affairs at Harvard and co-author of The Israel Lobby. What questions do you have about what's happening in the Middle East right now, the U.S. response, and U.S. goals in the Middle East? How much power does the U.S. have in the region at this point? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website, yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We will discuss media coverage of Attorney General Eric Holder's call for easing minor drug sentences. A judge also recently said the NYPD's stop and frisk policy is unconstitutional. We'll discuss media coverage of that ruling, and we will talk about coverage of the bloody crackdown in Egypt. That is tomorrow. Coming up on Monday, we'll talk about the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. This is a bus, really, that's traveling across the country, going to states where there are a number of restrictive laws, very few clinics. This group says that the message should be abortion on demand and without apology. But a number of national groups, like Planned Parenthood, for example, say that that's going too far and they want to distance themselves from that message. So we'll talk about, you know, what are your thoughts on the message at this critical time? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. Yesterday, Egypt experienced one of its bloodiest days since the uprising of 2011. Egyptian riot police, backed by armored vehicles and helicopters, launched a brutal crackdown on the six-week-long sit-ins by supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi. At least 525 people have been killed. And then in other news, we have in Syria, chemical weapons inspectors are going to Syria to investigate the alleged use of chemical weapons. 100,000 people have been killed there. Talks between the Israelis and Palestinians kicked off yesterday. There was yet another car bomb in Iraq, drones in Yemen. So much is happening in the Middle East. So we're putting this all in context, and we're talking about U.S. foreign policy there. What questions do you have about what's happening in the Middle East, and what do you think about how the U.S. is responding? There have been major power shifts. What are your thoughts on the United States' interests in the Middle East at this point? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We're joined today by Sheila Carapico, professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond in Virginia. She was just at the American University in Cairo this past semester. Stephen Walt is professor of international affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He is the author of The Israel Lobby. And Stephen, would you like to address Eid's comment? He also wanted to hear your thoughts on his comments.
Could you just remind me exactly what he covered a lot of different points.
Yeah, I mean, he's from Egypt, and he said that, you know, what he's seeing right now is nothing, nothing like he remembers in Egypt. People are, you know, much more open-minded. The Muslim Brotherhood is very foreign to him and the people that he knows.
Well, I think there's some truth in that. If you certainly go back to earlier periods in Egyptian history, it was a much more freewheeling society than I think some of the Brotherhood would want. But the other point to note is, first of all, the Muslim Brotherhood has survived in Egypt for decades, in part because the other forces and the Egyptian state has not performed particularly well, either under Nasser or under Sadat or under Mubarak. Had these regimes been able to, sustain a lot of economic growth, educate their citizens, and move forward, then it seems to me the Brotherhood would have found less support, less resonance within that society. I think some of his complaints about the Brotherhood are valid, and certainly Morsi's performance as president was exactly the opposite of what Egypt needed. What Egypt needed was a government that would be inclusive, that would begin to establish that even if you lost the last election, you weren't going to be suppressed, that you weren't going to be denied the opportunity to compete in future elections. And I think by attempting to monopolize political power, Morsi both lost popularity but also placed the military in a position where they felt they had to intervene. Now, unfortunately, we're seeing the military make exactly the same error, thinking that they can drive the opposition forces out of existence or underground. And I fear that this will only prolong the conflict and could, in fact, make it worse.
And what about U.S. conservative support for Morsi?
The United States, I think, was willing to work with Morsi. We didn't bring him to power. As Sheila has already indicated, there was no sort of secret conspiracy here. And I think the United States was ultimately disappointed in his performance, which is why you got the Obama administration, let's say, turning a blind eye to the military coup a month or more ago. It clearly was a military takeover, but we refused to call it that because we had decided that the Morsi government was heading in the wrong direction. The idea that we were sort of behind the Brotherhood, I think, is one of those conspiracy theories that is all too common in that part of the world.
And Sheila, people are now talking about, you know, will we see people speak out on the military? And there, people are talking about this on social media. What about the Obama administration and its response to how the military is cracking down?
Well, we touched on that earlier, and I think actually the caller that you asked about, I mean, he was saying that the Brotherhood provoked this confrontation yesterday or brought it upon themselves. And it's, you know, true that they were in a provocative couple of sit-ins and that their demand, frankly, for Morsi to be reinstated is not plausible on the face of it. But on the other hand, I mean, the military, we had heard that they were going to disband the two major sit-ins gradually over a period of days, first trying to get women and children out and then various other maneuvers. But instead they stormed the encampment and, you know, there were fires all over the city and now there's a curfew and Cairo is shut down. So things are very polarized right now. I mean, there are a lot of people like that caller and plenty of people on social media and also in conventional media in Egypt who are blaming the Brotherhood and supporting the military. But on the other hand, a lot of people are, you know, really disgusted and revulsed or experiencing revulsion about the resort to such extreme violence that it's bound to have a very negative effect on everyday life in Cairo, at least for the next month, because that's the announced curfew, but for quite some time to come. I mean, so the situation now, I think there's a third opinion in Cairo, which is kind of pox on both their houses, that the military and the Brotherhood seem to be inclined towards the kind of least constructive set of policies possible, and the vast majority of Egyptians are suffering as a result.
Let's go to another caller. Let's hear from James in Berkeley. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure. Go ahead. You're on the air.
My comment, when I was talking to the person on the phone earlier, was about how the language when it comes to discussing the United States' role in any foreign affairs is always sort of euphemistic and sugarcoated and whatnot, as opposed to the brutal reality that it should be. I think that we need a massive shift in the way we talk, and I understand that radio stations like this don't necessarily have a radical tone or maybe an angry tone, but to talk of what are the United States' interests in the area or what role should we play is really misleading, because I think you need to look more at the historical record and cease giving the benefit of the doubt to the United States that they can actually serve good in the area, when in fact it's always disastrous. It's always disastrous, and it's weird that radio stations and talking people on the radio always seem to give us the benefit of the doubt that we should or could step in and actually work some sort of solution here, when in fact the only step in when it's beneficial to us, and I'm sure I don't have to recount all the historical examples of this, but it's outrageous that we don't actually look at ourselves in the mirror more often and say, how about we don't interfere? How about we don't have a role? How about we don't send warmongers like John Kerry overseas to try to talk this over, because it never works out. You know, why are we keep sending in the same clowns and expecting different results? So I was wondering if you guys would talk about that.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. I mean, we talked about this a bit this morning, actually. Stephen, what are your thoughts on James' comment?
Well, first of all, I think that Americans should recognize that our ability to shape events in that part of the world, or in fact many parts of the world, reliably is limited. There is a tendency for American politicians and American citizens to think that if the United States does the right thing, barks in quite the right way, backs the right people, it will get all the outcomes that it's once. And politics is just more complicated than that. Other countries have their own interests. Other societies are often deeply divided, and therefore our ability to control outcomes in far-flung parts of the world is always inherently limited, and therefore our ambitions and expectations should be fairly modest. It seems to me it is realistic for the United States and for American citizens to want the United States to play a constructive role in the world, as opposed to a destructive role. And I think the caller is probably right. I probably wouldn't use some of his language, but that the American role in the Middle East has been far more negative than positive over the last 30 or 40 years. And as I said earlier in the show, we are now, in some sense, reaping the consequences of some of those prior mistakes.
And to add to that, Sheila, we just got an email from Todd that says the U.S. government pursues the interests of empire. How is it possible to ignore the elephant in the room?
Well, I mean, I think, I think that there's a big difference between thinking that the U.S. Pursues a policy of empire and then going to the kind of conclusion that therefore we succeed. I mean, I think there's no question that the United States tries to project power beyond challenge in the wider Middle East region, all the way from, Morocco to Afghanistan or something like that. But we don't succeed very well. And one example of that is that, last week we had 20 embassies in the region, including some in Africa and so forth, closed because of a terror alert supposedly linked to Al-Qaeda or maybe Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. We don't know much about that, and it's now kind of gone off our radar screen because of this horrible situation in Egypt. But that's not really a sign that we're succeeding in projecting power or that we're succeeding now more than 10 years into this war against Al-Qaeda. If it's still able to close down our embassies, then there's a problem with the policy. And it may indeed be kind of self-defeating in the sense that it continues to feed the kinds of tensions and also the kind of anti-American sentiment that allows a guerrilla group with not very much popular support to continue to frighten the United States and the rest of the Western world.
Well, and this is a big question, but I mean, what is the end goal here at this point? I mean, when the U.S. is seeing so much chaos, I mean, Stephen, how do you answer that question?
Well, I try to answer it by going back to what American interests are and then asking what policies would suit those interests or more likely to produce those interests. The United States still has an interest in oil in the Middle East, in having that flow out to world markets, if not directly to the United States. And the United States has an interest in limiting the danger from terrorism. We have an interest in discouraging countries in the region from getting weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons. And the United States has long had, I think, a largely moral commitment to Israel's survival. Those are, I think, the four core interests. The point is that for the United States to intervene militarily there, most obviously as we did in Iraq in 2003, is contrary to most of those interests. And some of the other things we've done, such as the blank check to Israel that has encouraged it to misbehave in various ways, is also not consistent with those interests. So my argument, I guess, would be that the United States should minimize its military footprint in the region, not try to tell all these countries what they have to do all of the time, not have a special relationship with Saudi Arabia or with Israel, but rather have a normal relationship with them where we criticize them when they do things we don't like and we support them when they do things that we do. And generally not take on what some would see as an imperial role in that part of the world, where I think it tends to make the United States less popular and also tends to threaten what our core interests in the region might be.
Well, we actually have a question about interests. So let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Yes, thank you very much. It is correctly said that one cannot have the right answers until one has the right questions. And I'm concerned that by using terms such as what are our interests, what do we face, what are U.S. interests, and running those together, which is really what is kind of an assumption and which is, has been said by yourself and by the guests, we kind of assume that there's some kind of common interest and that somehow we share that interest. Now, if I was a homeowner in Richmond, who was about to lose their home, I might have one kind of view of what the interests were in the area and how much the USA should invest money in it. Secondly, if I was working for Lockheed or Boeing making the weapons that are paid for by the people in Richmond, etc., I might have a different view. So I would like to know what you mean as the host when you use the term we, the United States, America's interests, and terms like that.
Well, interesting question, William, because I noticed this morning a lot of shows are doing this topic, and the host tends to say we, our. I don't do that. I always say the U.S. government. And I try not to at least say what are our interests or what are we doing in Israel-Palestine. I always try to say the U.S. government. But, I mean, when I say U.S. government, that's what I mean, is the Obama administration. But what are your thoughts on that, Stephen?
Well, it's a very good point that, you know, in any democracy, there are going to be different groups and different factions with different particular or narrow interests, and they are sometimes going to try and, you know, get the U.S. government to do things that are in their narrow selfish interest, whether or not that's in the broader interests of the country or most of the population. I wrote an entire book on how one particular interest group in the United States, the Israel lobby, tries to influence the U.S. government in the normal channels, the normal fashion, to adopt a policy of essentially unconditional support for Israel. It's how the American system of government works. I do think, however, that we can also step back and ask more general questions about certain policies and ask, are they policies that are likely to lead most Americans safer and more secure, or likely to make most Americans more prosperous? Not necessarily every company, not necessarily every arms manufacturer, not necessarily every ethnic group, but most Americans either safer or more prosperous. And that what we should be paying people in Washington to do is the latter, do things that are benefit of all Americans or as many Americans as possible, and not simply cater to narrow particular interests on one issue or another. So when I tend to think about what American foreign policy should be, I try to think about, you know, what are things that would make Americans safer or make them more prosperous? And if we're not doing those things, maybe the policy ought to change.
And how do you see it, Sheila?
Well, I mean, I think it's possible to, and I certainly don't say we when I mean the exercise of American power. I think Stephen has a very agreeable definition of interest, which are, you know, what makes Americans, you know, more safe and prosperous. But there is a kind of more cynical view of American interest as augmenting American power, and in particular American military power. And Stephen also mentioned this, sort of the American military footprint, so that when the kind of leading part of American policy in Egypt, for example, is arms exports, when we are continually pursuing these drone attacks in Yemen that presumably are attempting to make Saudi Arabia more secure and may actually be making Americans less secure, it shows that at least some people think that the American interest is the augmentation of American military power and its military role in the Middle East, the bases in the Persian Gulf and so forth, even the confrontational relationship with Iran. And so I think that there are actually different tones or different levels of analysis of what constitutes the American interest. And I think the caller is right to ask us about that, because that definition then is very important to what policies we choose.
And that is Sheila Carapico, professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond. This past semester, she was at the American University in Cairo. We're also joined today by Stephen Walt, professor of international affairs at Harvard and co-author of The Israel Lobby. We're talking about U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. We've got about six or so more minutes left, and we've got a line open. So if you'd like to weigh in on this, if you have any questions about U.S. foreign policy, what really strikes you about how the Obama administration administration is dealing with so many of these issues. And we're going to definitely talk about Israel-Palestine because that has been completely overshadowed by the bloody violence in Egypt. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann.
Another round of peace talks is really going to be a sham. Mm. And I was kind of feeling similarly, and I don't feel that there's going to be any substantial peace till the U.S. and Israeli, because I'm putting them in the same boat, pull out of the occupied territories. Because until that happens, I think that the peace talks are kind of a sham, and I was wondering if you could address that.
Certainly, I'd be happy to. I mean, unfortunately, and I say this with a great regret, I'm inclined to agree with you. I think it's very unlikely that these peace talks are going to go anywhere. It is, I think, to John Kerry's credit that he recognizes this is a continued problem for the United States, not our only problem in the region, but a big one. It makes our foreign policy throughout the region much more difficult. And finally, the continuation of the conflict, of course, threatens Israel's long-term future. So trying to do something and actually get an agreement, a two-state solution before it's too late, is an admirable goal. The problem is there's no evidence that the United States is going to pursue that goal in any different way. We're going to follow essentially the same policy we followed since the Oslo process began, which is to get peace talks going, but put pressure on only one side to make any concessions at all. And the Obama administration, both in the public statements it's made and in the people it has appointed, shows no signs of taking a different approach here, and therefore we're going to get the same outcome, which is no agreement, a further deepening of the occupation in the West Bank, and eventually, I think, the recognition, whether it's open or not, that there just isn't going to be a two-state solution. And this, I think, is going to be a tragedy for everyone involved.
Why do you think the U.S. has embarked on such an active diplomacy role now? Why is John Kerry spending so much time on this issue?
I think it's because he does understand that time is running out. He said very early on in his tenure as Secretary of State that we had 1 or 2 years to get a two-state solution. And if you think that a two-state solution is really impossible, then all of the other alternatives from an American perspective look far worse. There'd be much more of a headache for the United States. Trying to live with permanent Israeli apartheid, that doesn't look very good. Trying to imagine a one-state democracy there, that doesn't look very good from the United States, although you could argue it's consistent with American values. Thinking about further ethnic cleansing, that's horrific to behold. So you could see why Kerry wants to do something about it. The problem is, just as Obama was in the first term, Kerry's unable to actually do anything different. He's, I think, still hemmed in by domestic politics here at home, and therefore there's no reason to expect a different outcome here.
And Sheila, with all of this happening in the Middle East, I mean, you have to wonder how this is affecting Palestinians, because so many countries are mired in their own violence, and Palestine has always been such a central issue for people in the Arab world. Do you think that's still the case with so much happening?
Nowhere near as much as it used to be. I mean, it used to be, in a way, of course, it used to be that the plight of the Palestinians was part of the rationale for the continuation of the Assad dictatorship and the dictatorship in Egypt. And others in the region, although those two most notably. And now that those countries are very much, Egypt and Syria, of course, very much mired in their own problems, they don't have much patience or even attention span to devote to the Palestinians anymore, so it's kind of off their radar screen. I wonder, I mean, Stephen's last comment, which reminded anyone, I think, of the, you know, phrase that insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome. And it does seem like that's what we're doing with these peace talks. But the environment has changed very much. I mean, it isn't particularly alarmist to say that there's a real risk that the Syria conflict is going to spill over. the border between Syria and Iraq, and the conceptual difference between them is disappearing as we speak. The various what's going on in Egypt is not entirely separate from what goes on in Gaza, certainly, and the Egyptians actually have been very unkind to the Gazans recently. And so it's even more, I think, naive to continue to go with this bilateral talks between Israel and the Palestinian Authority as if that was completely separate from the tumultuous events that are gripping the entire region. And so you would hope that maybe this administration or a future administration really would come up with a more holistic foreign policy that doesn't treat, you know, Egypt as one issue and Libya as another issue and Israel-Palestine as another issue and Syria as another one.
You know, how would you get to that point?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is maybe a little bit outside of my, but I think that for one thing, the choice of people that we appoint to high positions in the State Department, including the secretary, but also a lot of the high-ranking officials, I mean, those are very political appointments these days. It's based on, you know, someone standing in the American public and not on any kind of regional expertise. And then when we do get regional experts like Martin Indyk, they tend to be members of Stephen's Israel lobby. So I do think that, you know, more reliance on serious expertise, even from within the State Department, actual diplomats or from academia, at least has some possibility of convincing this administration or a future administration that merely continuing the special relationship with Israel and Saudi Arabia and Egypt is not a long-term strategy for success.
And that is Sheila Carapico, professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond in Virginia. Stephen Walt is professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and co-author of The Israel Lobby. Sheila and Stephen, thank you both for joining us.
Pleasure talking with you.
You too. Thank you so much. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. A judge recently said the NYPD's stop and frisk policy is unconstitutional. We'll discuss media coverage of the ruling. We'll also talk about Attorney General Eric Holder's call for easing minor drug sentences and get the latest on the bloody crackdown in Egypt. We'll be joined by the San Francisco Chronicle's Bob Agelko, Alternet's Kristen Gwynn, and McClatchy's Nancy Youssef. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.